This podcast is presented by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, safer, healthier people.
Well, it's hard to pick up after Kevin. But I'll try. I would like to talk about completely different kind of robots. The robots that were designed for the purpose to communicate with the human beings. And this program, I hope in the future, will be part of the psychosocial rehabilitation program at the National Rehab Hospital, where I work at the moment. And I think the format of our presentation would be I'll give a brief overview of different psychosocial robots, and then I'll ask Cleo to play with the audience. And I was thinking that I'll just let her go so each of you have experience of interacting with this robot. If you want to move closer, that's fine. If not, then I guess people will do a little exercise. Or Renata can help us.
Is it alive?
Well, there are, I'll jump ahead a little, and before we see any of the schemas, this is a completely autonomous robot. It was developed as part of the EPET project by Omron Corporation in Japan. And we use it as a prototype for our future companion robot, which will have many, many different features. For now, this robot has only one button, which is on and off switch, and she doesn't like to be turned off, so I'm putting her in the working mode. And, well, treat her as if it were a real cat. The only rule is don't try to force her to do things that you think the real cat wouldn't like to be doing, like, you know, pulling on the tail or trying to turn her head off. So, Renata, Cleo will go with you. And I'll go ahead with the presentation.
Wait, let's go this way. I found this to do.
So as we witness and you can interrupt him and ask questions, so we'll make it like a real interactive session because everybody is a little tired. Invention of the microchip brought new technologies through the field of medical rehabilitation. There are four groups of technology-mediated therapies which formed their niche in the early 21st century non-pharmacological methods of managing different disabilities and illnesses. So we have, obviously, virtual reality, internet-based communication, and we've seen some wonderful examples today. And by the way, I had this strange feeling when we had the robot on the stage to shake hands with Dr. Reynolds in Maryland, although it was not possible, but maybe for some future developments, that might have been a nice application. We have electronic games that use for the disease management via simulated environments and self-guided trainings. And there is an emerging class of new robots that we call psychosocial robots, or robots with therapeutic potential. And this table represents how various human needs corresponds to the variety of robots that we have today. There's a class of industrial robots, research, military and rescue robots, recreational robots, and we've seen some examples of AIBO. There is a special class of companion robots, which still to be developed, although some of the basic features already implemented in a few models that we will see later on. So what are the two basic kind of defining features of the companion robot? First is that those robots were designed for the purpose of communicating with the human being on a personal level. It can be done by different things, and we will see that there are at least four basic factors that contribute to this companionship. And another basic feature is that those robots have lifelike appearance. So to mimic human beings is kind of complicated. So this is why researchers started with the animal-based models. Some other features are, and I'll show a few short video clips to illustrate those points. Those robots, the companion robots, simulate a real-life behavior, human-like or animal-like. They model emotional, cognitive, and other mental states normally experienced by humans. This is Cleo's brother, Cat Max, and he is asleep now on the desk in Japan. It's really empathic activity. And finally, they give a person an opportunity to communicate on different levels, from tactile, which is a really important mode for many rehabilitation techniques, to emotional, cognitive, and social behavioral. Some more features include an ability to maintain verbal and nonverbal communication, like those iBot dogs, or provide physical therapy for people with diminished skills, or like me in that case, with a limited set of experiences. This robotic hair karakuri is built in Japan, and there's a whole factory of those horses. It's a real-size horse that is used also in combination with the virtual reality environment and smell therapy. It's an analog robot, although it's guided by the special software and can be programmed to move with the different speeds. So basically, it serves two purposes. It provides rehabilitation for people with the back injuries, but also for the patients with social emotional deprivation to give them, to enhance their sense of control, which I enjoyed very much writing it. Finally, going back to communication on various levels, I want to show you a video clip of the robot Emmy that is friend from, if you translate it from French. This robot was designed by the Korean teams of engineers, and it also has a display, mounted display on the body, which serves a little different, a little different purpose. You can see that this display communicates about the inner feelings of the robot. So the robot trying to recognize some specific voice patterns and kind of tell you through the visual display how it feels. You can see it in the moment. The display has several human expressions, from curiosity to satisfaction. It also changes colors, and each color corresponds to the certain emotional state. And the heartbeat also symbolizes different mental states experienced by the communicating human. So, of course, people attribute it to the robot. And this is a this is an interesting tool for both people after traumatic brain injuries and persons with autism who can actually enjoy this visual feedback. Finally, we're getting closer to the cat. The robots covered with this specific synthetic fur can enhance the tactile senses of the interacting people. And this robot, Pero, was called by the Guinness Book of World Records, the most empathic and therapeutic robot. It was designed by the same researcher, Takanori Shibata, who also was a leading part of the designing team work on Cleo and Max, the robotic cats. Para is an interesting model. This animal was chosen to neutralize all the experiences that people have from their interaction with the pet animals. Because what happens pretty often when you work with the cat in the hospital or on the therapeutic session, probably 50% of the people would ask for a dog. They would say, well, do you have a dog, not the cat? And the answer is always, no, unfortunately, we don't have a dog. So what I'm saying is that past experiences do influence certain responses or the certain level of enjoyment that people might have experienced while communicating with the cat. Still, in our studies with people with disabilities, specifically those with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, well, mostly with Alzheimer's, we've noticed that those past experiences didn't interfere with the effectiveness of the intervention. So there are many, many dimensions that one need to consider when building a companion robot. First of all, its appearance, how lifelike the robot should be. Then it's a question of autonomy. Do you want this robot to be completely autonomous, or do you want to have some kind of a button that can, you know, elicit certain behaviors? And we will see later that for many groups with the special needs, people with disabilities, physical or mental, cognitive impairments, emotional disturbance, those profiles are changing. So questions, some questions that are, or some issues that are obvious to us are not so obvious when we, you know, immerse in the clinical context. Of course, it's interactivity, and then again, it's a question how much interaction is needed for a very specific population. And finally, it's a question about imitating behaviors. So all those are core questions on our ongoing project that we call Robotic Psychology and Robotherapy. And I do have some slides with the statistics. I don't know if I would be able to show it to you. If not, articles can be downloaded from our website. But what I want to say that we're trying to combine both qualitative and quantitative methods in our research. Because what happened mostly that you do a large-scale study, you get really good numbers, you have randomized controlled trial, repeated measures research design with the pre- and post-intervention measures, and you have all these great statistics, but sometimes numbers, they don't tell you exactly about the things that you're interested in. So this is why I guess the qualitative methods were invented, and some of the most known focus groups and case studies design and ethnographic studies. In our case, it was the study based on the website when we asked people to provide comments on what are the applications for the robotic cat. And I have some interesting and sometimes unexpected answers or suggestions for new fields of application. Now, since the cat is somewhere around, I can hear her meowing. I would like to show you this diagram that explains what's inside this robot. It has 15 actuators, 15 sensors. They correspond to human senses, but I think we have only three for now. It's a sound sensor, so Cleo can hear the can detect the direction of her companion. There is a video camera built in, and I can tell you the secret that Cleo sees through her nose, not through her eyes. So eyes do correspond with the movement, but the video camera is in the nose part of the body. And the most important, there are touch sensors. So she can feel the direction and the pressure of the touch, and correspondingly she can respond in a way that the person is expecting. And this is one of the main things that we're trying to build our research on, is to find what are the patterns, the behavioral patterns that differ one population, let's say one disability population, from another, and the people with special needs from healthy people. Or we're wondering if people with a spinal cord injury or children with a spinal cord injury have different reactions to the cat, and if they need a different companion than children who don't have the neurological disability. As you noticed, cat covered with the synthetic fur, which is also helping, because probably 20% of the cases that we have here in the US are concerned with people having allergies. So we have very interesting cases. Last week we were at the nursing home, and this 8-year-old woman who never interacted with the cat in her life because she's allergic to cats. So her daughter, when signing a consent form for the study, was really concerned with this. But since we had previous experiences that show people don't have an allergy to this cat, we told her that. And she was very happy to see her mother playing with the cat. She said, I wanted it for her for a very long time, and now she has this experience. And people do understand that this is an artificial cat, and it's not a substitute for the real pet. By the way, there was an interesting interview about our study on robotherapy in the Washington Post, when people asked all different questions, like ethical issues, that this kind of robots should be in existence, and is it a real threat? Before Kevin talked about threat to the humankind, when cyborgs will take over, in this case it's a moderate threat, but still they were asking if we would like to see robotic pets instead of the real animals, and the answer is always no, because when we talk about companion robots, I don't think we're talking about making them part of our lives instead of something, or as a substitute for, let's say, a human caregiver. We're talking about a certain type of intervention, in that case, maybe a substitute for a drug. And this is why we call this approach psychosocial or non-pharmacological approach. Because what we found, and those were pilot studies, and we hope to do it more rigorously, that people with depression, anxiety, and especially people with agitation, let's say in acute care, or an Alzheimer's care unit, they do tend to benefit from this intervention. So we might expect the decrease in medication intake on the Alzheimer's unit, and to find a better way to manage agitated, disruptive behaviors than the drug intervention. Again, this is not the substitute, that cannot be substitute for the drug in general, but a balanced approach that might benefit a lot of people who already taking lots of medications, like nursing home residents. Here is a little video clip so you can see what else this robot can do. Because actually, when you so it can shake hands, which is not actually cat's behavior, but people like it, because I've never seen a real cat who can shake hands with you. Normally it's a dog thing, but this is one of those factors that refer to mimicking behaviors. Is it a good mem or is it a bad mem? So those are all experimental questions. Okay, he didn't make it, but he can actually stand on his four. So the cat cannot walk, and that was also purposely done because it was designed as a companion for elderly people and mostly for people who is in need of companionship, but for different reasons cannot have it. And again, our research was successful with the Alzheimer patients, and I know about the research that was done in Japan on children with immune problems and autistic children who also benefited from the interactions with the cat. Now, before we go to the numbers, here are some of the after we had very very good media coverage, something like 3 years ago, we got hundreds and hundreds of responses to this invention, and which we were getting through our website, and mostly people were either sharing their experiences or asking how they can use the cat or offering their own vision of how this cat can be used, and that was done before we were doing any research. So some of those categories that that we derived from the web comments were actually guiding our research in the future, in our future studies. So I would like to give you some comments on the most common categories, which are the possible applications for this kind of companion robot. I have an 11-year-old son who was recently diagnosed with allergy-induced asthma. So our pediatrician informed us that unless we wanted to make the hospital visits a permanent part of our lives, my son could in no way have a dog or a cat. And that was a real tragedy because Andrew really likes the animals. Of course, all the names and places had changed. But when he saw the cat Max on TV, he was really excited. And for the first time, I saw hope on in my son's face. And so the allergies, asthma, and immune problems right away identified an area for application. And working with the National Rehab Hospital, we did the trial on the pediatric unit. And I'll tell you about those results in a few moments. So, we were able to show some of the statistically significant results for this intervention, specifically when it comes to allergies and asthma. Another comment. Wonderful is all I could say, and I want a robotic pet now for my 85-year-old mom. A lover of animals but unable to care for one, this will be the answer to her pet companionship. Just hope it purrs loud so the elderly could hear. So the social isolation, probably this should have been the first area of application. Social isolation due to age, illness, or disability is one of the basic questions that we investigated at the moment. How it can be relieved by providing people with the companion robot, and especially what are the psychological consequences of human-robot companionship. Another common concern, a person with a stroke. My father is in the nursing home after a stroke a couple of years ago, and I know he would enjoy having Max as a companion in the home. Before his stroke, he loved visiting with us and covering our cats. Now, not only people with disabilities or special needs considered Max or the robotic cat as at their potential intervention. I was surprised by two next comments. Here's one of them. I'm a paralegal. Doesn't sound like much, but the work behind the scenes in a law firm is very, very stressful. Even having Max on my desk to stroke and pet every now and then would be a blessing. not to mention the fact that every now and then we have young children in the office that need comforting due to their parents going through a divorce, separation, or other painful issues. And probably one of the most amazing categories, which was quite big, was to have a robotic cat as a companion for real animal. Here is one of the examples. I have a Siamese cat, Rocky, and he's very jealous. So I don't dare get him another cat in the house, but I think a robot cat might be a good companion for him. And actually, our friend in DC who has a spinal cord injury has a dog, and he's able to care for his dog, but sometimes he feels that the dog is kind of lonely. So we help him to buy a RoboCat so the dog can play with the cat and have some kind of an animated toy in the house. And that improved mental health for both our friend and the dog. And not, I don't know about the RoboCat, I didn't ask him about this. But I'm wrong. I did ask. And a couple of times when we had a really intense presentations with a lot of people in the room, the cat gets really tired. And you can see it by slowing down or going into sleep mode. So we have a joke that after such an intense presentation, we provide a robot therapy for the robot cat. But in that case, the robot therapy is very easy. You just turn it off and it goes to sleep. Now I would like to tell you a little bit more about the factors that we think lie the foundation of building a really successful companion robot. One of the factors that we briefly talked about is concerned with the appearance. There is an interesting hypothesis that came from the Japanese professor Masahiro Mori in 1970s, and it's called the Uncanny Valley. The meaning for this theory is that if robot is made more human-like in its appearance and emotion, the emotional response from human being to the robot will become increasingly positive and empathic, as we can see right here, until a point is reached beyond which the response become increasingly strongly repulsive. So, and it goes down. What it says that the appearance in motion, if they continue to become less distinguishable from a human being or a real animal, then it really freaks out people. So they don't want the exact copy of a man or the exact copy of a cat. And this is one of the reasons why you're able to shake hands with the cat, which normal cat wouldn't do. So you have this immediate kind of maybe even unconsciously response that you do understand that this is not the real animal. And we were concerned with this question when we work with Alzheimer's patients who, as you know, don't function very well in terms of cognitive awareness. What we've noticed is that they don't actually care about artificial nature of this cat. And I had several cases when I asked the patient, do you recognize that this is not the real cat? And the lady said, yes, and I don't care, I still like him. And by the way, the same response we got from children with a traumatic brain injury. And even for some of them who were not able to communicate verbally, we had the whole range of nonverbal positive responses that they do recognize that this is not the real cat, and still they enjoy his companionship. Now, we go back to this slide that we saw before about the, we identified four major factors that will make a companion robot successful. And those factors are actually mechanisms that can guide the behavioral configurations of the robot and also influence their physical appearance to be tailored to the specific needs of certain clinical populations. For instance, Alzheimer's patients, we've noticed that the level of interactivity really depends on the severity of impairment. And this is why we need to have the robot with the open tool for programming, so we can modify it for a specific group of people or even for the specific person. And hopefully in the future, the robot can modify itself based on the feedback and using the library of responses, some kind of a database that can help to make the right decision. The autonomy is a very important question, like how much of predictability the robot should have, or should the person be able to control the robot. For Alzheimer's patients, again, the complete autonomy was not such a good thing, because and we were expecting the opposite. We thought, well, autonomy is good, because you don't need to be with the patient, and it's a cost-saving intervention, et cetera, et cetera. But it turns out that for both Alzheimer's and children with a traumatic brain injury, the question of autonomy is really important. Kids with TBI, they were looking for the button to push so the cat can turn, its head left or right, or take the tail, or look at them, and there was no button. So they were a little frustrated. So maybe this is the place where telepresence can be merged with this kind of technology. So we have the nurse who, monitors 10 or 15 companion robots in the unit and can provide those responses for people who need this. Now, the opposite reaction of the medical staff was, well, basically, they also liked the intervention. But they were a little disappointed with the way how the cat looked. They said, well, we want it to be more kind of toyish. We don't want it to be that real. And also, they had the opposite sense of how autonomous should be the robot. They would like a full autonomy. They don't want this button. So that was one of the moments when we can really see discrepancy in the perception of the clinician and the patient in terms of the patient needs. And again, with the healthy children, we've learned that appearance is really important. By the way, can you tell which cat is which? Like, one of those is the real cat. So this is the real cat, and this is the robot cat. And for healthy children, again, interactivity and autonomy and all kind of positive behaviors were kind of on the right side, on the side that we would expect they would be. So they wanted the robot to be more interactive, more autonomous, to be very real-life looking. But for children and both elderly with disabilities, the profile was a little different and sometimes inverted. Okay, so the cat, where is it? Fell asleep? It's still working? Still meowing? Because sometimes it needs a little warming up. If you put it on your chest and stroke it, it starts, it's like a relaxing therapeutic intervention for the cat. So once in a while we do this. And another thing is the software that this robot uses employs what's called fuzzy logic, which is there is an input and an output, but we don't know exactly how things are connected. And this is what it makes interesting for people who are cognitively intact or for healthy populations, that you cannot predict robots' reaction. But you can learn from its behaviors on what are the positive or negative responses. And The cat has a variety of voice signals. I've never heard him hiss in this audience, but normally it does it like half and half. It both hisses and meows, so you can see that it can be upset because people don't treat it right. But I guess this audience is very well trained. After all, we're at CDC. So just a few numbers here. Our study involves now several hundred people across four different countries. The base is here in US, but we also have colleagues in Japan, Russia, and Ukraine. And we go there once in a while enjoying our trip and doing the study. And we have different age groups and, as I said, different clinical populations. We're trying to standardize our research procedures. So we have the session lasts 15 minutes. We do behavioral observations using specific software. We designed the human-robot interaction scale, which you can read about in the article, but this is one of the subscales, and some of the examples are the behaviors that cat can exhibit and how often people use this kind of behaviors, like shaking the paw, turning robot cat over, or what kids like to do is kissing robot cat and cuddling with it. Some of the cross-cultural studies are really interesting, and just an example that in Japan, people don't have a lot of eye-to-eye direct contact, so those behaviors are not very appropriate in the cultural, in the context of this specific culture. So when we look at the results, we should consider not only clinical context, but also a cultural one, especially here in the US when the whole culture is multicultural, if I can say this. Now, the study with dementia was based on the appropriate statistical model with repeated measures control design, and for the control we used a non-interactive plush toy. Also a cat very similar to the one that has a computer inside. And by the way, one of the reasons why this intervention is so successful in the nursing home is that they do have, although pet therapy is extremely lovable, and I personally like this approach, sometimes it's just not possible, especially for people with dementia who cannot control their many of their reactions, like with this person who tries to get the real cat. Yeah, sometimes the cat, you know, sense that this person may not treat him or her right, so they escape, but Cleo never escapes. She always stays with you. And she not only makes people happy, but also what we found, there are two basic reactions to the intervention. People show some interest, and sometimes very distinct interest, in the intervention. And I should tell that those people are either heavily overdragged or they have years and years of experience in the nursing home environment or as a confined environment. So mostly they are very apathic. And also, this intervention is helpful in managing agitation. This is some of the example of the restless behavior. And the same lady with the cat. So it's kind of similar to what Kevin showed us with the Parkinson's, although this is a non-invasive therapy, which can also work for some people better. So those are some slides on the statistics. So I guess I got to my conclusions, and those are that physical and behavioral configurations of the companion robot should be determined by the needs of target population. We cannot have a universal robot that will satisfy everybody, and I'm talking about companion robots, of course. The robot that we saw with the telepresence, I think, can satisfy any audience. companion robot, our study showed that companion robot triggers positive emotions and behaviors, and this is a foundation for the reciprocal relationships between the person and the robot. And finally, that those engaging robots with the different levels of artificial intelligence and all kind of sensory input and output are able to create a communicative loop that is actually very similar to what we have in human-to-human communication. Okay, I think I'm done. Thank you.